Welcome, I'm Emerson Green. I host Walden Pod and Counter Apologetics. If you're watching this on YouTube, I host this channel where those podcast episodes tend to find their way. You can leave me a voicemail at 734-707-1940, like these fine people did. So let's get started. So I'm going to take these pretty much in the order that they came in.
What is your view on personal identity? Are you a psychological continuity theorist, an animalist, or some other type of view?
Yeah, so personal identity. Well, there are really only two things that I cling to, and everything else is kind of negotiable. But the two things I cling to, first off, I'm a subject of experience with a point of view, and that's essential. You know, if you remove the subject of experience with a unique point of view, then I'm gone. You know, there's no more me. You can have everything else there, but if there's no subjective point of view, then I don't exist. So I think that's essential. Yeah, and other than that, I'm not getting in that Star Trek teletransporter thing. That is a murder machine. You're dead. It makes a clone of you. Obviously, how there's any disagreement about this, it honestly blows my mind. The way that I understand that transporter to work, it sort of copies your blueprint, and it you know, understands your structure, and it kind of beams your structure to, you know, Mars or wherever. And then it reconstitutes you over there on Mars after incinerating you here, wherever you are on the spaceship or on Earth or wherever. So you're dead, and now there's a clone of you. And the reason that people get confused here is because a clone is you and it's not you. You know, it's kind of both. Like, if you look at an identical clone, is that me? Well, in many senses, yes. But at least in one sense, no. And even if it's hard to articulate, it's like, look, clearly a clone is not me. So yeah, you can imagine getting into the transporter and it works, but it doesn't kill you right away. It kills you 4 minutes later.
He's good. I think something's gone wrong with your machine.
Yes, sir. I'm very sorry. There has been a mistake.
A mistake?
But you have actually traveled to Mars.
That's not me. It's just a large television screen.
No, sir, that's you.
I'm still here, miss. No. On Earth.
No, there has been a mistake and there has been a delay, but you're going to be destroyed anyway in 4 minutes. But everything is fine. You have traveled to Mars.
Yeah, so in that movie clip, I mean, does that seem like it's you? I mean, in some sense, yes, it looks just like you. It has all your memories. It experiences psychological continuity. In almost every sense, that is you, that copy of you, that clone of you on Mars. But in some sense, it's not you. So yeah, you can imagine getting into the transporter and it works, but it doesn't kill you right away. It kills you 4 minutes later. So are you going to be fine with that? Because, hey, I'm still alive on Mars. No, you are dead and there's a clone of you on Mars. But I mean, what's the difference between killing you immediately and killing you 3 minutes later? Or sorry, not killing you because you're alive on Mars. So, I mean, that said, I think there's something true about most of these theories of personal identity. They're kind of getting at something that's real. You know, psychological continuity theorists are obviously not crazy. And animalists are obviously not crazy. You know, an animalist thinks that as long as the animal body is structurally sound and it's not destroyed and it goes on living, then you're fine. You know, you're still alive. But animalism seems to rule out the possibility of like RoboCop. You know, like if you have most of your organs replaced with machine-like parts that kind of perform the same function, then it seems like animalists would be committed to saying that you're dead. So in the realm of personal identity, what I mean to say is I think that virtually all the theories are sort of getting at something useful, but they're not like perfect conceptual analyses of personal identity. There are pretty much always counterexamples. Does that mean we throw them out? No, I think that would be kind of crazy. I do have a lot of use for a phrase like former self, you know, like, oh, my former self thought this. Whether that has any sort of deeper implications, you know, I'm not sure. On the other hand, I do have this feeling of having a narrative center of gravity, more so than someone like Galen Strawson, who claims to have virtually no sense of that. He thinks that he is literally not the same person as he was 1 year ago. And, you know, like that would make sense if when you look back at something you did, even recently, you're kind of, you know, you don't really feel this sense of identification with something that you said or did. You kind of feel like, I did that. Like I said that. I believed those things. Like sometimes it's kind of shocking. So yeah, if we're not actually the same person, you know, from episode to episode, then that would make sense of the fact that sometimes we don't feel any sort of identification with our former selves. Phenomenologically, I do relate to a lot of the things that Galen Strawson says. I just can't quite go with him all the way, you know, saying that like, no, it's literally not me who did that 2 years ago. So let me just give an example of what I mean when I say that I relate phenomenologically to some of the things he says about personal identity. This is from page 34 of Things That Bother Me. Some people, it seems, live in narrative mode and wrongly assume that everyone else does the same. They experience their lives in terms of something that has shape and story, a narrative trajectory. Some of them keep diaries with posterity in mind and imagine future biographies. Some are self-narrators in a stronger sense. They regularly rehearse and revise their interpretations of their lives. Some are great planners and knit up their lives with long-term projects. Others have no early ambition, no later sense of vocation, no interest in climbing a career ladder, no tendency to see their life as constituting a story or development. Some merely go from one thing to another. They live their lives in a picturesque or episodic fashion. Some people make few plans and are little concerned with the future. Some live intensely in the present. Some are simply aimless. This can be a basic fact of character or the outcome of spiritual discipline. It can be a response to economic destitution, a devastating lack of opportunities, or vast wealth. There are lotus eaters, drifters, lilies of the field, mystics, and people who work hard in the present moment. Some people are creative although they lack ambition or long-term aims, and go from one small thing to the next, or produce large works without planning to, by accident or accretion. Some people are very consistent in character, whether or not they know it, a form of steadiness that may underwrite experience of the self's continuity. Others are consistent in their inconsistency and feel themselves to be continually puzzling and piecemeal. There's a lot in there that I relate to. I can't quite go as far as he does, but I agree that I am kind of tipping on the episodic end of the spectrum. But, you know, it's not an all or nothing thing. All right, one more quote from Emerson, the lesser Emerson, of course. So this is from an essay called Experience. Quote, "Where do we find ourselves? In a series of which we do not know the extremes and believe that it has none. We wake and find ourselves on a stair. There are stairs below us, which we seem to have ascended. There are stairs above us, many a one which go upward and out of sight." So that's obviously more abstract than the Strawson quote, but like I said, phenomenologically, I feel that way, you know, like there are these stairs behind me and I can't quite see all of them, but it's like, I think I went up those stairs. So yeah, I mean, there are a handful of propositions that seem true about personal identity, and there's no obvious way that I can see to make them all cohere. It seems like every thoroughly articulated view of personal identity leads to absurdity or paradox or makes you bite some weird bullet. So I remain pretty much agnostic about this. All I know for sure is that I'm a subject of experience with a point of view, and I would not get in the transporter. So next caller.
Hey, Emerson. Thank you for your work and show. I find it thoughtful and appreciate the topics you dig into.
Thank you.
Hey, I'd like to take a moment to unpack the relationship between individual phenomenal conservatism and group beliefs and experience. Given that human faculties are generally truth-tracking, it may be that awarding some credence towards widespread theistic belief is reasonable. In contrast, in the book Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman says, quote, "The illusions of validity and skill are supported by a powerful professional culture. We know that people can maintain an unshakable faith in any proposition, however absurd, when they are sustained by a community of like-minded believers," end quote. Can you talk about how we might consider issues and various considerations regarding individual versus group experiences, especially in terms of widespread theistic belief? Thanks again for all that you do.
Cool. Thank you for that. Yeah, group experiences. I mean, depending on what you mean by that, if you mean something like the tendency for one's beliefs to kind of influence the way that they interpret the world, yeah, that's a fascinating subject. If you mean more like the community reinforcement of beliefs, like that's what that Kahneman quote seems to be getting at. I think that signaling theory has a lot to say here. The whole idea of costly signaling playing a role in not only answering your question, but illuminating the origins of religious belief, possibly. I'm going to have an interview coming up on the cognitive science of religion, and we're going to be talking about signaling theory and hyperactive agency detection, sort of the ways in which we could explain the origins of religion naturalistically. And a lot of believers sometimes co-opt those, and, you know, we'll talk about that as well. But costly signaling, I think, is relevant here. So it just, you know, signaling theory, it sort of starts with an observation about the adaptive advantage of belonging to groups. You know, we're social animals. These cooperative groups can greatly aid in survival and reproduction. So, you know, anyone who's been a part of like a religious organization knows that there are economic opportunities. There are opportunities for finding a mate. I think the majority of people I've dated, I met at some kind of church function. I met my wife at a conference, you know. So it's like there are many benefits to belonging to an in-group, and religion is no different. So yeah, I mean, in some ways this generalizes to any group. You know, being a member of an in-group is beneficial to your survival and reproduction. But yeah, religion seems to, there are unique things about religious groups. You know, I don't want to say it's just like a bowling league or something like that. But yeah, I mean, there are economic opportunities, mating opportunities, and, you know, other human needs that are met as well. So yeah, there are benefits to group membership. But how do you ensure that people give and don't just take? You know, like, how do you maintain exclusivity? You can't have people just coming in and out, you know, taking and not giving. So they have to be like a real member of the group. And that's where costly signaling comes in. So, you know, there's no faking circumcision. And, you know, a lot of believers will sometimes do these crazy seeming things, you know, like Pentecostals will engage in this style of worship that's very off-putting to out-group members. And, you know, some of it's kind of embarrassing, and they kind of pride themselves in that. There's even this song called Undignified, where they're quoting King David, who like was going nuts at some point, and he was like, you know, I'll become even more undignified than this. And, you know, that was something that really struck a chord with people who worship that way, because, yeah, I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. I mean, there are other reasons that that sort of worship style emerged, I think, but one of its functions, I think, is this kind of costly signaling. Now, again, I don't want to be too reductionist about this. I'm not saying that's all it is, and, you know, but I think it's definitely part of it. I think that this costly signaling, you know, it's a signal of genuine group membership, you know, so it's hard to fake, and it weeds out the free riders, you know, the people who take and don't give. So I think this way of signaling, you know, the way it works is it reinforces belief internally as well as assures the group members that you're in. So I think that cognitive dissonance can explain how once costly signaling behaviors are engaged in, it's significantly less likely that you're going to leave. Significantly less likely. So your beliefs will be more solid after you pay a high price for them. So, you know, and I think that that's pretty well understood, you know, in like cognitive dissonance literature. So I think that costly signaling can at least partially explain the origins of religious belief. There are so many benefits to survival and reproduction to group membership, and costly signaling plays a role in the maintenance of these groups. So from that point on, it's just like ordinary social transmission, like from parents and familial groups to children. And I think that that, along with cognitive dissonance, in turn, can at least partially explain the persistence of religious beliefs. Obviously, there's a lot more to say about the cognitive science of religion, but I think that you're totally right that people are capable of believing all kinds of crazy things if it's kind of reinforced by a group. And I think that we can understand that in evolutionary terms as a form of costly signaling that maintains and perpetuates this group, which is extremely beneficial to survival and reproduction. So costly signaling is kind of necessary for the maintenance of these groups. And I think once you engage in that costly signaling behavior, it reinforces the belief in the community and in yourself. Once you start paying a high price for it, I think we know that that means that you're less likely to abandon that belief. So you combine that with plain old familial transmission and inertia. And, you know, a lot of these forces just seem to come together to not only explain, at least partially, the origins of religious beliefs, but the persistence of them. So, like I said, there's a lot more to say about cognitive science of religion, but if I were trying to respond to that widespread theistic belief argument that you mentioned, you know, we have these generally truth-tracking cognitive faculties, they overwhelmingly seem to produce belief in God. I think that providing a naturalistic account of how these beliefs might have arisen and how they persisted, that would go a long way towards answering that sort of widespread theistic belief and just, you know, satisfying the curiosity of, you know, what's going on with the persistence and prevalence of theistic belief. Sometimes believers will co-opt these models. They'll say, yeah, it's a good thing we've got a hyperactive agency detection device, you know. It's a good thing that all the, you know, as a believer, I can accept all these things that you're saying, and that's just how God planned to bring about religious belief. Just because you discovered the mechanism doesn't mean that God didn't sort of set the whole thing spinning to begin with. And, you know, I mean, this is a familiar move. You know, we discover evolution, and at first it's resisted, and then it's like, oh, I guess this is how God chose to create. You know, and it could be the same exact pattern once we get a better grip on the origins of religious belief. So, you know, in my mind, the best response to this is just sort of a simplicity argument. Like, the whole thing works with or without God. God is explanatorily redundant here. He adds nothing. Like, the whole thing works in exactly the same way if God didn't exist. So if God doesn't exist, this is how it would work. And apparently if God does exist, this is just how he chooses to do it. So, you know, it's not just that your model is, like, you know, marginally less simple. It's just, it adds nothing. It's just a wheel that spins and contributes nothing to the actual explanation here. So, you know, as usual, yeah, the data of our world, it's consistent with theism, but it's not exactly what you would expect. And it's better explained by naturalism. You know, if you can explain more with fewer assumptions, that's generally a good thing to do. If you're just looking at these two theories, these two models, you would opt for the one that's more parsimonious and doesn't have, you know, fifth wheels that are just spinning pointlessly off on the side. All right, thank you for that question. And we're going to move on here to the next caller.
Hey, Emerson. What do you think of analytic idealists like Bernardo Kastrup or the phenomenologists like the Sensorama guy? I can't think of his name right now. Do you have any thoughts on the plausibility of these arguments? Thanks.
And there's a follow-up.
Hey, Emerson. I'm sorry, I just called. And I said the Sensorama guy, his name is Michael Pelczar, and he wrote a book called Sensorama, a Phenomenalist Analysis of Space-Time and Its Contents. He has a sort of phenomenalist version of idealism. I'd like to get your thoughts on those arguments of analytic idealism or phenomenological idealism. Thanks.
Yeah, so I'm unfamiliar with the phenomenological idealism, but I am somewhat familiar with analytic idealism, like Kastrup's idealism. So for those who don't know, this is not like Berkeley's idealism where the matter out there, like there's no mind-independent reality. In Berkeley's idealism, God is necessary. You need this other mind that's kind of observing things all the time, basically. Like, it's an explicitly theistic model of idealism, and I don't really know how it would work without God. So Kastrup's idealism is not like that. It doesn't require a God, and there is a mind-independent reality on analytic idealism. So it's just, there's no reality that's independent of the category of mind, but there is reality that's independent of your mind and of the minds of human beings and of non-human animals. It's just that, in essence, all of the matter that we see is mental. So I think that panpsychists and idealists are friends. I just think we're one big unhappy family. And the differences between the camps, I think, is sometimes exaggerated. But, you know, there are differences, but they're kind of minor. Like, if you're looking at things from like a 10,000 foot view, There's literally no difference. So let me just play a clip of Bernardo Castro really quickly to show what I mean.
So matter is just what conscious inner life looks like from a perspective. If I look in the mirror, I see my conscious inner life presenting itself to me in the form of an image in the mirror. If I look at somebody else's brain on their brain scanner, the images I will see on the monitor of the brain scanner are what the inner life of that person, the conscious inner life of that person, will be looking like from my perspective. So I would even define matter as what experiential states look like from a perspective.
So matter is what experience looks like from a perspective. That is exactly what panpsychists believe. Idealists are our cousins, you know, if they're not our siblings. But once you get more into the weeds, then yeah, there are differences. And I've noticed there also seem to be like personality differences between panpsychists and idealists. But, you know, that aside, from like a 10,000 foot view, they're just kind of the same thing, you know, like matter is what experience looks like from a perspective. I mean, that's pretty much exactly how I try to characterize panpsychism. Like when you perceive me, you don't perceive my feelings and experiences and this kind of first person subjective stream of consciousness that's going on all the time. You see brain activity, you know, you see behavior, you see my facial expression and my body language. And if you were to conduct brain scans, then you could see things in really fine grained detail and you could probably figure out what I was feeling or thinking. You know, it ultimately relies on self-report. Even if you could just look at a brain scan and figure out what I was thinking, that is going to, at the very least, be based on all the previous research that's been done that relies on self-report, because experience is not observable from a third-person objective point of view. You know, it's only observable from a first-person subjective point of view. So when we kind of look out at the world, we see matter. Even when you know experience is present, like in my case, you don't perceive experience, you perceive matter. So there's no reason to like multiply substances here. You can do that if you want to. You know, like I've said before, you know, 4 days out of the week, I'm a panpsychist. 2 days out of the week, I'm a dualist. And 1 day out of the week, I just give up and I'm a Mysterian. but on those days when I'm a panpsychist, this is how I view it. You know, here's a quote from Thomas Nagel that I refer to all the time. We ourselves are large scale, complex instances of something both objectively physical from outside and subjectively mental from inside. Perhaps the basis for this identity pervades the world. Panpsychists just think that the contents of consciousness change depending on the arrangement of matter. So you change the arrangement of matter in my brain, and you change the contents of my experience. So before anyone flips out here, I'm not trying to give like a rigorous, comprehensive argument for panpsychism here. I'm just kind of thinking out loud and contrasting it with analytic idealism, which I think analytic idealists would basically agree with literally everything I've said up to this point. So from a 10,000 foot view, there's just not really a difference. I view them as our cousins, if not our siblings. But yeah, I mean, I like Kastrup. a lot of people don't. But I think that's because he behaves, you know, like physicalists behave. You know, he's kind of arrogant. He's kind of cocky. He can come off as kind of, I don't know, abrasive to some people. But I mean, listen to Patricia Churchland. You know, listen to your average physicalist argue with a non-physicalist. It's that same, his attitude is not significantly different from many other people in philosophy of mind, but because it's going in the other direction, people are like, whoa, where's this aggression coming from? It's like, I don't know. It's just, it's frustrating when Kastrup basically acts like most physicalists act most of the time on the internet. And then they're acting like it's this unique thing, but you know, he's not antagonistic like that all the time. He actually seems like a nice guy. And I really appreciate his contributions. You know, I really find so much to agree with in what he says. I don't know why he seems kind of uptight about panpsychism. He's adamant that, you know, that they're not the same thing. But one time when he was in a slightly less confrontational mode, he admitted that cosmopsychism is just another name for analytic idealism and vice versa. So I've never heard him say that before or since, but he said it at least one time. But most of the time when he's talking about panpsychism, he, you know, kind of outlines this one particular version of panpsychism. You know, he says it's like incompatible with modern physics. I don't know why he does this. Like, I wish he wouldn't. I mean, it just feels kind of straw man-y. He clearly wants idealism to be the word that people discuss, you know, not panpsychism. And I kind of agree with Donald Hoffman that idealism has kind of uniquely bad press. like it's kind of associated with being anti-science. I mean, it's not, but it has that connotation. And it makes people think of like Berkeley's idealism. It makes people think that you're like not a realist about tables or something. Sometimes if you say you're an idealist, people will say, why don't you jump off a building, you know, and test if there's a mind independent reality. And of course, like analytic idealists do believe in a mind independent reality. So it's just kind of like, it's even worse than the example of like, you know, I refute idealism thus, and then kicking a stone like Sam Johnson did. I think Timothy Sprigg wrote a poem about Sam Johnson and that whole comment. Maybe it was Sprigg, maybe it was someone else. But it was something like, kick at the rock, Sam Johnson, break your bones, but cloudy, cloudy is the stuff of stones. I mean, we don't have access to the intrinsic nature of matter, just like you don't have access to my subjective experiences. Okay, so let's take the next call. This is a bit of a longer one, and it happens to be from John Buck, who I debated on the existence of God just a couple weeks ago.
Hi, Emerson. This is John. I was just going to call and leave a message regarding an interesting, I guess, sort of thought experiment regarding philosophy of mind. So I'm sure you're like aware of the ship of Theseus problem, where like you have the ship from Theseus that over time gets replaced board by board until you get to this point where all the boards have been replaced. And so what can you say is really the real ship of Theseus, the ship that has been replaced all this time, or the pieces that are left over? And it sort of got me thinking of like maybe a sort of argument for substance dualism of some sort, where if we think about the material constitution of the brain, and if we were to imagine that we were able to like replace every single particle of that brain with like some sort of artificial particle of some sort, and then would we retain a sort of like sense of identity or consciousness throughout that whole process? I think David Chalmers makes a similar sort of argument, but I don't know, it just seems like if we were able to like safely replace every single particle of my brain individually, I would probably like continue to exist, I as in the sense of self or the subject of experience throughout that whole process. Maybe I won't. Maybe at some point I do cease to exist. But I was thinking, if it were the case that I did continue to exist, it would seem then that my sense of self, or maybe not even that, but just the subject of experience, the sense of consciousness with a continuity, did survive that sort of like reconstitution with differing matter. It would seem then that that subject of experience cannot be reducible to any of its material components. So this gives us reason, I guess, to think that the subject of experience exists independently of those material constituent parts. Now, maybe it is the case that, well, I don't know. That's just sort of something I've been thinking about that's making me a little bit more sympathetic towards substance dualism. I guess that wouldn't initially just get you to substance dualism, but maybe other things as well would sort of make substance dualism more plausible, such as like mental causation, something of that sort, which gives us reason to think that the subject of experience actually has causal powers, so it must be some sort of like substance, some sort of concrete entity, rather than just be like properties of some other substance. Anyway, just something to ponder on. So hopefully this call-in show works well for you. All right, bye, Emerson.
So there are a couple questions there. As for the original Ship of Theseus issue, I'm kind of inclined to think there's no objective answer to which is the real Ship of Theseus. You know, so if you imagine there's a ship, and over the course of, you know, however many years, it's replaced board by board as, you know, it gets damaged and it gets more and more worn. And someone has been saving each piece of the boat, and then they reconstitute it in a museum somewhere, and it's rickety, and obviously it couldn't sail because all the parts have been damaged. But it's the thing that originally left the harbor. And there's this other thing that's still out on the sea now called the Ship of Theseus, but there are no original parts that are there, you know. But I think there are other things that matter besides the material composition and the structure. I think there's also the causal history that matters. So you might think, well, hey, if it's nothing but the material it's made out of, you know, the arrangement of those particles, then yeah, that could lead to certain problems. But I think once you add that bit about causal history, then I think that that can cut off certain issues with different conceptions of personal identity or something like that. But in this case, with the ship of Theseus, it's like, I mean, they both have causal history, you know, they both have, they both seem to meet the criteria. And yeah, I think that maybe this is like a good argument for a soul, right? Maybe there is no objective answer because the ship of Theseus doesn't have a soul. But yeah, I'm inclined to think that there just is no, there's no answer to that question. So when it comes to human beings, this is relevant because our physical material is constantly being replaced and changed, and yet it feels like I persist through time. So if I had a non-physical soul that persisted through physical change, that would make it really easy to have an objective answer. So maybe that's a good argument for a soul, you know, because it best explains the persistence of identity. Of course, we could just reject that premise. Like, we could just deny that identity persists. So someone like Galen Strawson wouldn't be persuaded by that sort of argument at all, because he thinks that there's not really this persistence. So, you know, it's like, oh, there's this persistence through physical change. And he's like, no, there's not. So even though I wouldn't go so far as to deny persistence, I think that persistence is kind of exaggerated and overplayed. You know, it's not like there's this unchanging pearl at the center of everything. Like, there's this core, like this, you know, this ineradicable me at this, like, I don't even know if that's true. That doesn't mean I'm denying persistence totally, but I just think some people exaggerate it. And I think that there actually is like a variety of experiences when it comes to personal identity. And, you know, that has to be taken into account. But, you know, I mean, who can deny that, like, if we had a non-physical soul that persisted through physical change, it would make it really easy to explain persistence through all of that, you know, replacement that goes on in our bodies over time. But, I mean, first of all, our physical structure does generally persist. The material itself gets changed out, but the structure is very important, and that does persist through time. But it does kind of change a little bit. But then again, so do you. So it seems like that's actually not a bad explanation either. One potential problem for the substance dualist view here is that there are genuine cases of dissociative identity disorder, which used to be called multiple personality disorder. So are there seem to genuinely be multiple selves in this one vessel. So, I mean, like, are there multiple souls, you know, in their brain? You know, because this isn't like demon possession. These are like two human persons who seem to have been split. And then there are, you know, split brain cases where people, you know, they're not mentally ill, but you can, it seems like kind of the natural interpretation of split brain data that there are two autonomous agents and they don't really know what the other one's doing all the time. Yeah. So, I mean, DID cases, split brains, those are kind of hard to make sense of on substance dualism, if you ask me, because it's like, what happened? Was there another soul? That was added to the mix, you know? I mean, the souls can't be split. They're supposed to be these sort of basic things, you know, these things that can't be divided. So souls can't be split, but it seems like there was one person in this body and now there are two people. It's not a matter of possession. You know, it's not like demon possession. There are just two human persons, sometimes many human persons in the same brain and body. So that seems like a potential difficulty for the, you know, substance dualist answer to this. Like I said earlier, it seems like there are many propositions that seem plausible enough about personal identity, and it seems kind of impossible to make them all cohere under one framework. As for the mental causation bit, I mean, if you're committed to thinking that people are just the material structure that they are, you know, it's the material, it's the arrangement of the material, I think they're not going to have any trouble explaining something like mental causation, because they think that physical things have causal powers and you're just identical to this particular physical structure, which has causal powers.
Hi, Emerson. I just want to say I really like your YouTube videos and your perspectives. We definitely disagree a lot since I am a Catholic and et cetera, but I find that the things you say are really interesting and insightful, and I have never really thought about panpsychism or the idea that one could be an atheist, not just deny certain basic truths about reality. Very cool to listen to you and get your perspective. And I think that you're a great thinker and a YouTuber. And so I wanted to thank you for making those videos. Take care.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I'm glad that I have had that small effect on you, that you don't think that atheists are necessarily unreasonable, that we don't have to deny, as you said, basic facts about reality. Yeah, so I mean, even though you're a papist, I guess we can still be friends. So yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. 7347071940 is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.